I've seen some of your books, and one of them's on my Curious England book one. It's definitely on my wish list, which I'm hoping to get very soon and start reading. But looking at your background, I could see that you grew up in the West Country, and to me, I've been there a lot recently: Cornwall, Somerset, Devon, Dorset, all these places. Looking around, filming a new series. And I thought that this region, it's steeped in folklore, it's mystery, all the monuments are there, megaliths, King Arthur stories, this ancient landscape. It must have had a really big influence on you becoming a writer.
I mean, I grew up in Somerset, and from an early age, I can remember being very interested in the sort of the remains of the past that were all around us, really. I mean, up on the Mendip Hills, I can remember the round barrows from the sort of Neolithic and Bronze Ages. There were the remains of a Roman lead mining settlement nearby. And in fact, in our comprehensive, just in front of it, when they were building it in the 60s, that they had to move it back a little because they discovered the remains of a Saxon palace
Oh, wow.
there. So when every day when I went to school, I would see these sort of sort of co pieces of concrete which marked out the post holes of the palace. So history, sort of deep history, was all around, and it sort of merged with folklore in many places. So I grew up sort of on the edge of the Somerset Levels, sort of lower slopes of the Mendip Hills, and Glastonbury was nearby with all of its quirkiness and strangeness. The Tor, the Holy Fawn, sort of legends of it being associated with Avalon and so on, and the Tor itself allegedly being some gateway to the fairy world, the underworld, and so on. And nearby was Wookey Hole as well, with its infamous witch, or the legend of its infamous witch, which in recent years I believe has well, they've now got a witch in residence, haven't they? I think it's changed a bit since I was a kid growing up down there. It was a bit more basic back
Well, of
then.
course, as the theme parks move on, and everybody has to up their game. Can you blame them, really? I do seem to remember that the witch, when I was there recently, we did a piece for this new series there in Wookey Hole. The witch that was outside, the cackling statue of the witch, was the same one, I believe, when I was young, which was quite a while ago. So I thought, gosh, I think this has been here for about 40 years. Which was that, that was very amusing to see that. I mean, all of those caves, the skeleton that they have now of the alleged witch, the story of the monk, and even the caves themselves. What a history! The first cave diving cave, all the discoveries, all of the and modern cave divers still practice there, don't they? Very frequently.
They do,
And I
yes.
just thought, this is amazing. So much more to this. Again, theme park, natural theme park, as it were, then meets the eye, and it really was steeped in history. Never mind the cheese, of course. Let's not forget the cheese. So great place, and all of them, the tour as well. Some wonderful characters up there. I think we met a man with a real bear head hat, who was driving this coach up and down to the tour, transporting people from Glastonbury to the tour, and he looked like he really belonged there. And we tried to interview this chap. He was a nice guy. So I can give you 2 minutes because there's a thunderstorm coming tonight. I need to get up to the tour and take these magic mushrooms I've got before it
Oh my
starts.
God,
And I thought, well, I'm sorry to keep you. Clearly, we'll be as fast as possible. And thank you for your time. And off he went to sit in a big building on top of a hill in a lightning storm, which isn't the wisest of decisions, but I'm guessing
No.
he's still there.
Yes. Yeah, there are a lot of characters in Glastonbury. That's for sure. It's a singular place.
It really is. But I say that in a positive light because we met some great people there, and of course, I'm sure it attracts some. Like all popular places, some less than savory characters from time to time, but the vibe overall was a good vibe. It was a nice vibe, and people seem to be quite receptive. Let's talk about stuff like your books. You've got lots of books. Some of them I know are fiction, and some are a reportage of stories and folklore and histories. And I was very interested in the book I mentioned, Curious England, the book series, number one. I'm wanting to learn. Casual and Idiosyncratic Guide to Some of the Folkloric and Historical Curiosities of Rural England, Towns and Smaller Cities. That's your description of it. So, I'm fascinated always by folklore. Can you just share a few peculiar tales from the book with us?
Well, I suppose I'll just briefly say what sort of prompted me to do this, really. And it's just that I think that everywhere in England, really, well, across Britain, wherever you go, there are lots of stories attached to places, and most of the time people don't know about them. But you just scratch the surface. You go into a local church or something, and suddenly you will happen upon something. You will happen upon, I don't know, some tomb. You'll go away and you'll look up something about this person, and suddenly you will find this window opening up into the past. And sometimes there's some very strange stories indeed associated with these places. For example, in the first volume, I suppose, one of my favorites relates to the Dent Vampire. Have you ever heard of the Dent Vampire?
No.
Right, so Cumbria isn't exactly renowned for vampirism
Not
in the
vampire country,
popular, no, not
no.
really, not in the popular imagination. But since moving up here, I've happened upon two vampire stories. One in Croglin, which is a very small hamlet in the northern Pennines, and the other in Dent. Now, Dent is a very picturesque little village with a couple of nice pubs and a rather interesting church with some beautiful 17th century carving in there. And Dent formerly was in the West Riding of Yorkshire, but at some point in the 70s it got sort of, annexed to Cumbria in one of these reorganizations that they have
Oh, yes.
periodically. But anyway, the story goes that some 3 centuries ago, Dent was visited by its very own vampire. Now, this vampire was not some sort of stranger from overseas, like the archetypal Dracula or Nosferatu. It transpired that he was a local man. But
Wow.
he wasn't suspected of vampirism before his death, but rather after. And his name was George Hodgson. There didn't seem to be anything particularly remarkable about him other than his great age. So he was born in 1621, so back in the reign of James the First. And he was said to have led a blameless life. And when he passed away at the age of 94 in 1715, which was quite an age for that time, he was buried in the community in which he had always lived. However, shortly after his burial, a number of strange and dark rumors began to circulate concerning him. A number of people swore that they had subsequently seen him both in the village and further afield in Dentdale.
Gosh.
Some thought that it was his spirit that wandered, whereas others were convinced that it was his undead body that had physically crawled from its grave back into the land of the living somehow. So it was now that strange stories began to circulate concerning Hodgson. When he was alive, these rumors started to fly about. One man claimed to have been a friend of the deceased, affirmed that he knew him to have drunk a glass of, can you guess what?
Oh, blood.
Yeah, indeed, a glass of sheep's blood daily, though, sheep's blood rather than human
Oh, I
blood.
see. Okay.
Whereas a neighboring farmer had an even more damning story to tell. His claim was that George was a shapeshifter, able to transform himself, rather like Mrs. Mothersole in M.R. James's The Ash Tree, into a hare. So, in support of this latter assertion, he recounted an incident from some years earlier. One day, having shot a black hare and failed to kill it, He followed its trail of blood right to George Hodgson's door. He then peered through Hodgson's window. What did he see? Well, something most unexpected. Hodgson was absorbed in the work of dressing a gunshot wound. Huh. The explanation for him, at least, was clear. Witchcraft. So, by now, thoroughly unsettled, the good citizens of Dent convened a meeting. The upshot was that Hodgson's body should be exhumed. It is not recorded how long after his death the exhumation is said to have taken place, but his remains were found to lack the normal signs of corruption. The corpse's skin was pink and healthy, and both his nails and his hair had grown. He was, they concluded, undead. And so they did what they believed they had to. George was buried at the church door with a brass stake driven through his chest.
Goodness.
And this, it seems, proved sufficient to prevent him from walking again, for there have been no subsequent sightings of the Vampire of Dent. So, that's one Cumbrian vampire that I'd never heard of before I happened to visit this little village. Whenever I go somewhere, I tend to take a lot of photographs. I like photography. And sometimes I'll go there and I'll know a bit about the history and the folklore beforehand. And I might want to get pictures of particular artifacts or buildings and so on. But on other occasions, it's only afterwards that I discover the rather unusual stories attached to these places. I suppose my approach to this, my sort of fascination with these unusual stories that are linked to all of our villages and towns, was prompted by a wonderful book that I'm sure you're aware of that came out originally in 1973. I could scarcely read at that point, but but it became a childhood favourite, Folklore, Myths and Legends of Britain, which had a wonderful gazetteer format, and it broke the country down into regions, and in each of them it had these wonderful maps upon which you could find symbols for ghosts and hauntings, witchcraft, giants, buried treasure, and so on. So in a way, this is a bit of an adult homage to this wonderful publication from the 70s that had such an influence on me as a child. It sort of created that lifelong love of folklore and unusual stories. Now, there were some tales in that book about cryptozoology, but of course that would have been connected with black dog lore and so on. In more recent years, as you'll be aware, it tends to be big cats, black cats, rather than dogs, that fascinate the public imagination.
And indeed, a
friend of mine that claims to have seen one of these in Suffolk in recent years, as well as having had an encounter on the edge of Exmoor. But it seemed to transpire that what he eventually saw was a large log in a piece of woodland there.
Although at least he had the foresight to go and check it out and make sure it was what he thought it was. And so few people do that these days. And what I've said to a lot of people who've published photos of big cats, or footage especially, is the difficulty with big cats is all cats from a distance look more or less the same. And without anything for scale, it's very hard to tell whether you're looking at a big cat running across a field or a morgue running across the lip of a hedge. And it's a tough one. I definitely believe they're here. I know too many people have seen them, but still, I'm not sure if we're seeing as many as we think we are.
No. And I suppose whilst on the subject of Cumbria in this first volume of stories I've gathered together, there was a rather ghoulish character who went by a number of different nicknames during the day, none of them complimentary. One of them being Wicked Lord Jimmy. Unfortunately, whenever I say that now, I keep thinking of a rather more contemporary unpleasant Jimmy. But you know, the less said about him, the better, probably. So, Wicked
it
Lord Jimmy.
Crossed my mind. Yeah.
Wicked Lord Jimmy of Lowther Castle. Now, he was an incredibly wealthy and influential man in his day, and he owned a vast amount of property around Cumbria, including a number of pits in the west of the county. So the wealth generated by those was sort of pivotal to the growth of places like Workington and so on. And he had such political influence that really he controlled the nomination to nine parliamentary seats up here in this part of the world. And he was also known as Jemmy Grassball and the Toadstool Earl. So you can see he had very little affection amongst the common people. Indeed. So he was born back in 1736, died in 1802, and he was very much a man of his time and his class. So as you'll be aware, you know, Georgian England was home to many a rake hell. And Lord Jimmy raised hell with the best of them. So you know, his wealth and power obviously placing him in a position where he might act as he wished with impunity. And this is what he did. So along with dueling, womanizing, he relished driving his carriage and riding at breakneck speed along the highways and byways, and was known to cover the 300 miles from his home to London within 3 days.
Wow.
The latter must have led to the occasional altercation on the highway. And indeed, in 1792, it is recorded that one such incident led to a duel with pistols at dawn. Thankfully, the other party, Captain Cuthbertson, came to no physical harm, although a pistol ball made a rather neat hole in the flap of his coat. So they made up, though. They resolved the dispute with a handshake.
Fantastic. No harm was done. I'll let you off with a slightly ruined overcoat and be about your way. Yeah, indeed. I think it's amazing, though, to think that there's so much here. And one of the things that some American friends and others in newer countries, so to speak, often, I think, don't realize is literally has been a country here with recorded history for so long. Just so
yes.
Long. And even what hasn't been orally or written about our past is there in stone, is there in barrows,
it is,
and mounds,
it
and,
is, yes.
And everything else that we find. And it's just amazing. There seems to be an endless treasure trove of things to investigate for such a small island.
Indeed, and new things are being discovered all the time, of course. And with respect to this this Earl I just mentioned, that was just a bit of a preamble, really, because he went on to do something far, far stranger than that. Like many of his class, like most of them, he didn't marry for love, and his marriage was unhappy. But you know, unlike love, his hatred for his wife didn't fade, and his hatred was reciprocated. So he was a bit of a womanizer, and he took up with a number of women, including one of the sort of, you know, common women on his estate. He was absolutely besotted with her. And it just so happened that she died at quite a young age. And he didn't seem to be able to accept her death, really. And for some time afterwards, now this is where it gets really ghoulish. He would, after she died, he would go and dine with her. He would have her sort of sat up in the crypt, as it were, fully dressed, and he would dine with his former lover. And some want him to sort of be prized away from her. So she was kept in this sort of glass, this crystal kind of coffin for a while.
Oh dear.
When he died, I mean, this
you
is
look
where
as beautiful as the day I met you. I mean, you can imagine the compliments, can't you?
Oh, good God, yes.
Dinner.
Yeah, but So, you know, such characters, because they're so hated, they attract a lot of stories. So the tale goes that when he died, there was an earthquake in the church, and he leapt from his coffin and attacked the vicar. And had to be sort of put back in. This was after death, you know, his spirit sort of leapt out, attacked the vicar.
How to go with the vicar. What do you think is the background to those stories? Is it very much about superstition and place and time, where we were as a religiously superstitious nation, or do those things persist to this day in our modern population, but in different ways?
I think they do take different forms now, yes, certainly. But of course, back then it was more of an oral culture. And if someone like this wicked Lord Jimmy Grasp or whatever, if they had a bad reputation, I'm certain that stories about them would have gradually got embellished over the years, and different variations on those themes would have emerged. So we eventually end up a couple of centuries later, 2 or 3 centuries later, with something incredibly lurid, a very sort of rich repository of folklore associated with one of these larger than life characters, which of course would not be the posterity that they would have wished to be remembered for. Because sometimes you can, you know, go into a church or a cathedral and you will see certain characters laid out and represented in all their pomp and finery in some wonderful effigy, which must have cost an absolute fortune. And at the same time, there will be sort of rather scurrilous tales circulating about them, which will have come down to us. Yeah.
I
So
suppose
who
it's all in
knows?
the dearly departed, much loved, beloved notices on every grave that you see, and whenever you see on any grave, usually that the person was despised and hated, and
Yes.
they're gone. Do you? It's
No.
always the good ones that die somehow. Yes, and I suppose if you can't see anything good, why is anything at all? I think that's probably a religious principle too. You don't libel the dead, so to speak.
No.
Do you think then that these stories growing in their veracity and macabre nature after such a person's death is almost a way for those living who suffered under them to stick it to them once they're gone a little bit?
Absolutely, very much so. I think that is the case. And you never know. I mean, we may well find our own new sort of
Oh
folklore
gosh.
growing up around certain characters who are despised these days in the future. But of course, with libel laws and so on, that will have to wait a while, you know, until they're long dead and buried.
Oh gosh, what are we talking here? 70, 80 years?
Well,
I hope it's not that.
I'm sure. I know it seems very terribly tasteless at the moment, but I'm absolutely certain that a certain other wicked Lord Jimmy is going to become a Halloween fixture in decades to come. I'm quite
Oh
certain of it,
gosh, I don't know.
given his rather ghoulish proclivities.
You mean a British Lord Jimmy, so to speak? Oh, that Jimmy, sorry. Yes, of
That
course.
one.
That reminds me, actually, all of these places that you visit, these that have stories, sometimes maybe macabre. I visited the Little Dean Jail. Have you ever been there in
No, I
Forest of
haven't.
Dean? It's the Museum of Good and Evil. Spoiler alert, there's not much good in there. I
Oh,
mean, and
right.
on the side of good, that is, but all of the things that happened down through time are represented there in photos, in mementos that have been taken from the places, costumes, and etc. And they had the tracksuit of Jimmy Savile,
Oh, good God.
on a similarly made out, I would say like a Madame Tussauds reject
Oh,
version
right,
of him,
yes.
but you can't go wrong, really. Just make it ugly and blonde, and you've got it. I just thought this is insane in a way. This was a monster, and yet here he is
Yes.
entertaining people
Yes.
due to his monstrous nature in this macabre museum. And it was very strange, and a very interesting place, but a place that's also very nice to leave.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for the tip, because I hope to be holidaying down near that neck of the woods later in the year. So, I'll be looking out for all the local curiosities, Southern Herefordshire and Forest of Dean area.
Well, the building itself is also a real marvel and has its own histories. I think the last person to be jailed for witchcraft, she was imprisoned there and actually was freed, if I remember correctly. Because and she represented herself. I'm trying to remember her name now. Unfortunately, it slips my mind. But it was a very interesting story that this jail was then bought by a stonemason who clearly had some personal interest in the dark side of life and filled it up with these mannequins and tombstones and photos and two-headed lambs and all of the Victorian type of things you can imagine. And he was the nicest guy. If I'd met him in the pub and we'd had a chat, there's nothing about his personality that would have told me that if I'd gone back for a drink, at the house, that's what I would be meeting when I got there. It was quite strange. Let's talk about ghost stories as well. I mean, I know you've done a bit about that. I love a good ghost story. A lot of what we look at today, especially because of these ghost shows all over the television, it's been recycled too many times. All the authors now stick to the classics for fear of being overlooked by publishers or the algorithms, really. You're struggling to meet the algorithm to get selected on Amazon or wherever you've put your work. You wrote a book of personal ghost stories, and that was crowdsourced from one of your Facebook groups. And I thought that's a great way to come up with those stories. That's an inspirational way, actually, to find fresh and untainted ghost stories.
I mean, the book, to be honest, the group members asked me to publish it, so I did. I didn't start the group with the intention of publishing the book, really. But over the years, quite a few good stories came up, and people started asking me, will you publish it? So I thought, well, okay. I suppose that one of the difficulties is with Facebook, as you're probably aware, that the way that it operates, unless you pay Facebook to show people your posts, they tend to hide them. So even within my own group there that I created, the Personal Ghost Stories group, when I put the post up for people to see, I've decided, I've got time this year to publish the book. Would you like your story to be included? A lot of people, I think, didn't see it, unfortunately, and some missed out on it. So there may be a second one at some point. Who knows?
I'd love it, and I think that's another one that's going to make the list, because I think, sure, we've all got strange encounters of our own. Perhaps most of the time we've never shared with more than one or two people, but to have them out there in print, as it were, for all to see, and to bring new light to these experiences. They're there through the eyes of those witnesses, directly through their eyes, instead of I suppose, our purview as the authors, what we would like to select and what might sell best. Talking about books, I mean, you're obviously you've written so much. You're a very prolific writer. You write supernatural fiction as well. You state that it was because you become jaded with contemporary works that you'd written Christmas ghost stories. Throwing your hat into the ring, getting some new Yuletide yarns of yesterday, or at least with the spirit of yesterday. And I wondered about some of those stories. Maybe you could share them with us, but also what you think is so sorely lacking in our world today that we can't produce stories in the same vein as we did yesteryear.
I suppose actually my profile, I wrote I was jaded with academia, so I'm through with academia. I'm fed up with that. So yeah, I thought I'd turn my hand to fiction. I do like a good ghost story. I think in recent years, generally speaking, although those good ghost stories do continue to be written, there's been a bit of a move away from the genre of the pure ghost story, and it's gone more into sort of horror. And it's gone more into sort of jump scare territory, which isn't really my thing. I know some people like it, but it doesn't float my boat, really.
Same.
I wanted to write some ghost stories which were a bit more in a traditional vein, sort of early 20th, late 19th century, that kind of thing. So drawing upon the inspiration of writers, obviously, like M.R. James, E.F. Benson, Edith Wharton, Elizabeth Gaskell, and so on. There's so many of them, so many brilliant ghost story writers of the past. But I must admit, I do sometimes, I can't help it. I've got a rather wry and satirical sense of humour. Uh-huh. So some of them also have a bit of a strand of dark humour threading through them.
give us an example.
Let me see. I suppose the first ghost story I wrote, it was prompted by something quite unusual. One of my visits, actually, to a rather modest manor house in Somerset. And as I was walking around it, I saw these really two unusual looking objects stood either side of the main hearth there. And I looked at them and thought, these two old girls look sort of distinctly kind of uncanny, a bit sly, a bit malicious perhaps. One of them in particular had a slightly smirking, malicious expression on her face, and they were these sort of mannequins, and they were made of leather, and they were sort of in Jacobean attire, and they had these rather unusual expressions, and they were about 3 foot tall, and the guide there said, oh, they're called the Good Companions. She said, we don't know exactly how old they are or where they came from, but we think what they were used for in the past was that if you had, say, 13 guests to dinner, which obviously was not considered to be good luck, they would bring in one of these good companions and sit her at the table to make up the numbers.
Wow.
Well, anyway, this just planted a rather quirky seed in my mind, and I came up with this ghost story that I set in the early 20s, just after the First World War, called Old Crotchet. It's quite a light-hearted piece, and this old Crotchet, as she's referred to, was sort of inspired by one of these mannequins, but I won't say any more about it than that.
No, sure. We'll buy the book and have a read. But that sounds very. I mean, already the setup. To sound like something I definitely want to find out. I'm really gonna have to. I'm gonna end up rinsing out Amazon at the end of this conversation, and I'll pay for it with the wife. But never mind that. Look, I think I think it's important though. It's important to have that level of imagination, and I suppose what I wanted to find out from you is, and in my question I might have actually misunderstood what you've written about thinking that today's stories don't have the same superstitious elements as they did yesteryear, and I wonder if it's because we once had a corporate religion that was a uni religion, so to speak.
Yes.
And now we all have very individualistic beliefs for the most part that although based upon that corporate religion, are now lacking, its sense of reverence or fear for the afterlife and and for this divine, watcher who could punish us. Do you think that's what's perhaps missing in today's society? We're not as scared as we used to be of the other world.
I think perhaps, generally speaking, we're not as scared or shocked by many things. In a way, we've become sort of inured to the grotesque through just exposure to everyday life that's going on, around the world, terrible things. So a ghost story by comparison seems rather tame. But I think there's something in what you say about that sort of lack of a sense of, a sort of shared spirituality, be at a sort of residual level amongst people, even if they're not sort of overtly, pious or whatever. And a diminishment in a sort of sense of awe, a lack of a sense of awe.
That's what it is. A lack of a sense of awe.
But I think with a lot of ghost stories in the past, the more traditional ones, the ghosts usually have a motive. quite a few of my ghosts, I must admit, tend to be quite vengeful.
Okay.
But quite often, the stories are prompted by a really wide range of things. Sometimes it's an artifact I stumble across. Or for example, just noticing one day when I last visited Wells Cathedral, which is beautiful. You're probably aware of the wonderful medieval clock there.
Yes, I've
And
been there, yes.
on the outside, there are these two figures, these late medieval soldiers. They've been standing there since about 1475, which is incredible. And they still bang the bells, every quarter or whatever on this clock. And there are two words. Let me see. I think, are they over them or under them? I forget now. Anyway, it says nequid periat, just two words in Latin. I thought, well, what does that mean? I mean, I'm no Latin scholar, so I went away and looked it up, and it means let nothing perish. And I thought, ah, that's a great title for a ghost story. And it, my imagination was just sparked then. I wrote a ghost story just based upon those two figures and those two words, nequid periat.
Wow.
I won't tell you where it goes because it spoil it. It's
No,
only a
again, yeah,
shortish story.
exactly. Gosh. It says it's the oldest clock in the world. Is that right?
It's one of the oldest, yeah. It's possibly the oldest functioning, although I think it's been
Perhaps still
refurbished.
functioning clock in the world.
Yeah,
Yes.
yeah.
Okay, I see. Wow, I mean that is amazing. I mean, and that's the thing. Britain, the British Isles, in fact, we have that, and we forget it. We're always looking afar, to these adventurous places where we can visit, and
Yes,
or
yeah.
fun places where we can sit on the beach. But really, the adventure, I think, is right here. It is right here. And last summer, when I think we did something like 11,000 miles all around the country,
Wow.
it was a real eye-opener, especially living in London for so many years now. The trail of accents, going from the south to the west and east and all the way up to Scotland, the trail of ever-changing accents and even appearances of people was quite something to behold. And I thought, we're not really one people at all, but a group of peoples that have become one over a long period of time and sort of settled in our respective areas and grown to understand one another, which was it was a funny thought to have. And within that, there are these range of classic stories like pixie stories and stories about kings and fairies and ghosts, etc. And I wondered if you had noticed in your travels, in your folkloric travels around the country, are there differences, for instance, between a classic Scottish ghost story, or an English one, or Saxon one, for example, or a Welsh one, Irish one, or do you find that they all have the same overall pattern?
That's an interesting question. I'm not that widely travelled, really. Hence the name of the series, Curious England. I need to get up to Scotland more.
No, that's fine. But even within England, do you find in the different places, because of course Somerset is different to Cornwall, and again, it's
Yes.
different to the Midlands and Suffolk and Surrey and the rest of it. Are there those influences from our ancient forebears that predominated in those places, culturally speaking, that changed the nature of the types of ghost stories or black dogs or pixies, whatever
Yes,
that there
yeah.
might be?
I mean, I may be wrong. I may be completely unobservant here. I probably don't know enough about it, but it strikes me that sort of pixie lore, that sort of thing, it's more associated with sort of further southwest, sort of Cornwall, Devon, maybe West Somerset, rather than up in, say, Cumbria. How much have I come across relating to that up here? Not much. A little, perhaps, but not a great deal. I think I've only stumbled upon one reference to it up here. Like you probably know more of it than I do.
No, I've not heard of anything that way at all, actually. And that's a good point.
So it does vary. The sort of what do they call it? Yeah, the sort of water spirits like Janet today, Janet Foss, and so on. They seem to be associated with particular northern rivers, like someone else mentioned today, Peg Powler. She's associated with the Tees up at Barnard's Castle and other places. There could well be. East Anglia, of course, for obvious historical reasons, has more of an association with tales to do with witchcraft and so on.
Lots of black dogs.
Black dogs as well, of course, Black Shuck being the most famous there.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great story, you know.
It's
action-packed from start to finish.
Absolutely, yeah. Blythe Burn and so on, which reminds me of a sort of similar story in a way, or set of stories set on Dartmoor, of course, with the Wish Towns and so on. Rather like it, Blytheborough, although it wasn't interpreted as a visitation of the devil when was that? I think it was 1636. There was a terrific storm in Widdicombe in the Moor. And the local people were all gathered in the church on the Sunday morning when the storm struck. And looking back, we think it was probably ball lightning. Anyway, the church was struck with lightning. One of its pinnacles came crashing down from the nave roof, taking a few people out with it. And then in came bouncing this incredible fiery orb of light, sort of touching various members of the congregation, killing a number of them, burning them hideously, but leaving their clothes untouched.
Goodness.
I think about 9 people died that day, and a few weeks later, and of course they interpreted it as a visitation from the devil, as they would have done it that time. And within only a week or two, you had 2 pamphlets published in London, you know, like the early tabloid press, detailing this great storm, this marvel in Widdicombe. A couple of weeks later, you had another one with extra details, you know, of what happened to some of the victims and so on. And when you go into the church today, you can see on a set of boards there, it's these painted black boards, the story is sort of written up there as well. That's quite fascinating, yeah.
Do you think we look at the past in a way that it's with the view that's a long time ago, but actually when people like you or even I delve into these things, this is not really in the scale of things so long ago. Records were kept, stories are maintained, and very often the way, as you mentioned there with the early days of the printing press, the way in which they were recorded, you know, means that they're still possibly out there. They could still be found and accessed as a research source.
I completely agree. It's odd. I don't know if you find this. It's strange. I mean, I'm 50 odd now, but I find that the older I get, the closer the past seems. I know that's paradoxical because I'm further away from it, but I think 100 years, 200 years, it's not that long ago, really. Even 300.
It's not. But it's because you've lived a certain amount of time, and we're not too far apart in age, but you've lived a certain amount of time, so you know how quickly that amount, that passage of time can run.
That's right.
And you probably remember your forebears and older people in the neighborhood. I remember talking to my great grandmother, who was born in 1896.
Yes.
And the next door neighbor, Gertie, who was, I think she was nearly 101, and she still had gas on in the house.
Wow.
For lighting. And
for lighting,
my father
amazing.
This is in the sort of late 70s, early 80s. You used to have to go in there and sort of fix it up for now and again when things stop working. Who knows how long She'd had it, I guess her parents had it, and she inherited the house and just carried on. And
That's
it's
amazing.
amazing, but there we are, people in the 2020s who are associated by contact with people from the 1800s,
Yes.
And so it is on and on and on.
Yeah, exactly. Because I can remember my own grandmother telling me stories about what would he be? Great great grandfather. So born in about 1850. So there's that sort of unbroken memory, really.
Yeah.
So it can easily span two centuries. So it's not that great a time.
It's not. No, which is why I think it's so important that people such as yourself are preserving these stories, are remembering them in print,
yes,
publishing them for everybody to find out about and to read and enjoy. Now, I know many writers today, as I was previously before last year, armchair researchers. It's clearly not the case with you. And I've always enjoyed these informative posts. They're really detailed, looking at your field trips so over the years. And I think it's rare for writers to get in the field. But I was wondering, just before we finish, if you could share your three favorite sites that you visited, most memorable.
Okay, for different reasons. Well, one of them would be Light's Cary Manor. And that's simply because it inspired my first ghost story. As I just mentioned, that's in Somerset. It's quite a pretty little place. I mean, for normal mortals like us, it's a big house. But in the grand scheme of things, when you're talking about this, it's not a stately home. It's a good sized manor. So I'd recommend that. It's got a nice atmosphere about it. For a number of years, it was used as a farmhouse, and then even as a sort of, partly for storage for a number of years. And then it was sort of renovated by some rather wealthy individual who bought it up during the sort of era of the arts and crafts and had it restored. Stoke Dry, the church in Stoke Dry, St. Andrew's, that's very interesting. My wife and I went on the holiday, when was it? Three summers ago. It was just after they released us from one of those awful lockdowns. So we had a few days away. We stayed a couple of nights in Rutland, which I'd never visited before, and then went down to Suffolk to meet up with a friend and have a look around there. Anyway, the first day of our holiday, oh my God, the rain. I've never seen rain heavier. Anyway, so ironically, we go to this place called Stoke Dry, get out the car. It's an absolute biblical deluge. Unlike a number of the churches during that summer, which were locked because of COVID, thankfully, St. Andrew's was still open.
Good for them.
So we dashed in there. And the sight that met my eyes was quite striking. It was like something out of a horror film, because down all the whitewashed walls were these streaks of sort of russet red. It looked like the walls were bleeding.
Wow.
And this was simply because someone had stolen all the lead from the roof back in 2018.
Oh, no.
So, the rain was coming in, masses of rainwater, it was getting into the timbers, and this sort of red pigment was streaking down. So it looked like blood, which was quite a dramatic effect. But unfortunately, it was running very close to some 13th century wall paintings, which were rather unique. There was a really strange theory attached to one of them, because it showed St. Edmund being shot at by two archers, so two Danes. These were only sort of discovered beneath the whitewash in the 70s, and two of the conservators who were called in came up with this rather wacky theory.
Okay.
That they represented North American Indians.
Huh?
Yeah, exactly. Painted in the 1200s.
He's a little early. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And it was their claim that, this was some sort of folk memory of Norse contact with the Skraelings or whatever.
I think that was
rather imaginative.
Mm.
The Parvis, this sort of little room above the main entrance to the church, over the porch. You could climb, you could get up into it, up these really tight, winding, narrow steps. So I went up into there, and it was a compact little room. It felt quite nice, but it had a couple of stories attached to it. One being that, now this, it transpires, there's no basis for this, but this folk belief grew up in the area that it was in this little room that the gunpowder plot was hatched. Now, it is true that the parish did have an association with one of the plotters. I think his name was Sir Kenelm Digby, and he was hanged, drawn, and quartered for taking part in it. So that's probably where the tale came from. But then, if we jump forward just another 40 years, so another 17th century yarn, the story goes that a local woman was accused of witchcraft, and for some reason, they imprisoned her in this little room above the church porch and locked the door, and they left her there with no food and no water. And this poor woman,
Hard.
screamed out, calling for obviously sustenance, water, for food, and so on. And the visitors shunned the spot until she had died. Then, after this, the story goes, her ghost has been heard to frequent the place on occasion. Her shrieks are still heard there, although not on the day that I visited. So whether there's any truth to that story, I don't know. Whether anyone ever was locked in that room, who knows? It's supposedly in the 1640s, during the sort of peak of the witch mania,
And this is in
during the Civil
Suffolk.
War. Oh, sorry, this was in Rutland.
Oh, so
Think
you said
dry.
Rutland.
Yes, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah,
Yeah,
we were
okay.
on our way to Suffolk. We stopped off in Rutland
Okay.
for 2 days. Yes, yeah, so
Wow.
Stoke Dry. And lastly, Bampton Grange in Cumbria. Simply because my wife and I were having a holiday in Bampton nearby, and it was, the weather was terrible, stormy. And I did some writing that week, which was good, but we didn't get out much. And on the Sunday, in a break between the storms, we thought, oh, let's get out, let's stretch our legs. So we walked down to Bampton Grange, and there's a bridge over the River Lowther there. And it was running high and dark, and we crossed that, and we went into the church, which was nothing special to look at at all. I thought, well, let's see if there's anything interesting inside. And so we went in, and no, there wasn't really that much interesting inside. Now, we were feeling a bit, I don't know, a little bit passionate, I suppose. So we had a bit of a, I don't know, we had a bit of a hug and a kiss there, and we'd just been looking at this list. You go into churches, you often see the list of the previous rectors, the vicars, going
Yes.
back to the 1100s and whatever. And there were a couple of gaps there, generally signified by either the Black Death or the Interregnum, during Cromwell's era, when the clergy got turfed out. So we'd just sort of finished our clinch, as it were, and something rather strange happened. Now, this is the only, I hasten to add here that both my wife and I are sort of non-belie, we're very skeptical people, right? Yeah, we're not really, how can I put it? Yeah, neither of us had ever had an experience like this before,
Oh, I
and
see. I
had
see.
anyone told us about this, we would have sort of, oh, that's
You
nonsense,
didn't have it
nonsense.
on the brain, so to speak.
No,
No.
that's right. So anyway, we were interrupted in our moment by the distinctive sound of the lift and fall of the iron latch of the outer door in the church tower. And then there was this sort of muffled sound outside of someone milling about beneath the tower. It was immediately succeeded by the upward click of the latch of the inner door. And then there was a curtain outside of it, right? Long curtain, from the top of the door to the floor, and it started billowing because it's a very windy day. It started billowing inwards. And I thought, right, well, obviously someone's going to pop through that now. And then nothing. Nothing at all.
Gosh.
There was no doubt, I didn't hear a corresponding downward click of the latch or clunk or rattle. It was just complete silence, yeah. So I walked over. I thought, oh, this is odd. I pulled the door to completely and looked into the area beneath the tower. Totally empty, nobody there. The other door still shut. No breeze, nothing. I thought, oh, it's a bit odd. Anyway, we thought, oh, we may as well leave now. So my wife went out and I went to close the door, the inner door, that is, and it was stuck fast. So no matter how much I pulled at this door, it wouldn't budge at all. So I then thought, okay, it must be snagged on something. So I went back inside, looked around, see if there were any obstacles. Nothing, nothing whatsoever, right? So I tugged and tugged at this door and it would not move, just wouldn't move at all. Three times I tried it, nothing. And then the fourth time, all I did was I touched the latch and I li lifted it. I lifted the latch, I didn't pull it, and suddenly it just slammed with this massive force. It just slammed in my face, kind of thing. There
Wow.
was no one else in that church.
And I mean, it couldn't have slammed because you didn't put any force into that point.
No, but that's what it did. That's what it did.
You were ushered out.
So I was kind of, oh, I had a bit of a tingle up the spine then.
Yeah.
So
The
we
Lord
sort
was unhappy with you making out in church,
of. Exactly,
and you got
yes.
shown
So
the
we sort of looked at each other and left without, pausing any further. Closed the outer door carefully behind us,
That's
and
right.
whilst we're walking down the path, I glanced back, it's a bit odd, and nothing, no one there, and you know what it's like in ghost stories, or certainly if it's in film or on television, you say, oh, I'd never go back. Why are they going back? You'd never go back, would you? Well, the next day, anyway, we went back because I was curious. But unfortunately, the church was locked. So that was a really
That's
strange day. So
very
that's why I had a
unusual.
special. That's why it's got a special place in my heart for me, as it were. But no matter how hard I've looked, I've not been able to find any other reports of anything unusual connected to that church. No stories associated with it.
That is strange. I mean, but then, does every place have 100 stories, or does sometimes people just do they sometimes just experience the odd, occasional anomaly, as you did?
It's strange. I mean, I suppose if you look at it from, of course, the sort of Fortean perspective, the idea is that, of course, well, with science, with the scientific explanation of the universe and physical processes, it's all based upon experiments being able to be repeated ad infinitum,
Replicated,
isn't
yeah.
it? But yeah, I suppose the Fortean attitude is, but what if things do just happen sporadically, occasionally, and we've just not sort of adapted our model of the universe to also account for these and incorporate them. So what's actually going on there? What was that? What was that? I don't know. Some people might call it a ghost, a haunting, or some other kind of supernatural phenomenon.
Could it be? I mean, this is just me trying to rationalize everything as always. In the same way as the ball lightning was a strange and supernatural phenomenon to the churchgoers who had the who were frazzled by it when it appeared, taking their lives and collapsing the steeple. There could be other unknown scientific forces at work. That unexplainable at present that caused your experience.
Yes, yeah, it could be. It could be. So yeah, that's the only time that we've except for
Oh.
no, this was another weird one, but it wasn't like that. It's so yeah, this is an odd one. We were driving along a road, quite a local one, and there are hedgerows either side, right? No houses, no roads leading off. And there were a couple of corners in it, and at one point you can see oncoming cars on a rise before they go into a little dip and then re-emerge. Anyway, we were driving off to get our groceries one Saturday morning, and nothing out of the ordinary, just a typical grey day, not very pleasant, not raining. Visibility was good, and saw this sort of grey estate coming towards us, and went down into the dip, and we went around the corner to meet it, and my wife and I just looked at each other and said, "Where did it go? This car had just
Disappeared.
vanished. It had just gone."
So
So
strange.
yeah, so actually I've had two inexplicable events. So yeah, that was
Have you heard of the stone tape theory? You know, the theory for
yeah.
Walker, you know, regularly appearing ghosts, the Grey Lady, you know, the White Baron,
Yes.
that kind of thing. That somehow almost like a pinhole camera, you know, under the right conditions, records what's in front of it, that these environments create, I suppose, a type of studio that records the
Yes,
incident
yes.
and replays it time and time again when those conditions are replicated. What do you think about that?
Who knows? Possibly. I mean, I'm struggling to come up with a rational explanation for it because I don't think it was a double hallucination because we didn't remark upon the car
No.
until we both looked at each other
And it was
and
gone.
said, "Where did that car go?" So we'd both seen it. So
Wow.
yeah,
No
I don't.
turnings, no offs,
No
just
turnings, nothing.
no little
No.
ditches, and you just drove away from the scene of an accident down the hill, and somebody's wheels are still spinning in a ditch, nothing like that.
No. It just wasn't
Wow.
there.
That's amazing.
It wasn't there. So
That's really amazing.
I don't know if you've heard any like that before about
Not
vanishing cars.
cars, actually. No,
Yeah.
it's normally, you know, people on horseback or people walking. Oftentimes,
Yes.
there's a few in Cornwall. There's one they tell the Jamaica Inn, which, you know, it's hard to judge
Yes.
really, because of course, one might say they've got more than their fair share of ghostly happenings for a very popular
Yes.
ghostly tourist destination. It's almost too good, but I don't think they make them up. But people report them very regularly. And again, who knows if that's because it's on the brain, you've gone there to see ghosts, suddenly you see ghosts. It's like the Bigfoot thing, you know, every time somebody reports one, it just seemed to be that they really, really want them to be real at the same time, so
Yes,
it's
yes.
hard to divide those two interests. I don't know. I think yes, lots of walkers who disappear suddenly, you know, as the car passes or just before they
Yes.
reach them.
Yes.
Which is strange. Strange and ghostly. And again, I wonder, are these scenes that were recorded by the natural environment being replayed occasionally for us when those
Yes.
conditions are replicated? I mean, how do we, in the old sense anyway, how did we first start to record these images? You know, we realized
Yes.
that we could put things onto a magnetic strip and replay them, and wonder if
Yes,
there are
yeah.
other ways of doing that.
Well, one of those sorts of stories that seems to be quite common, of course, is of a figure crossing the road and suddenly vanishing, and quite often people thinking that they've hit this figure, and of course there being, thankfully, nothing there.
Oh, yes, of course.
And there's a story like that in the Personal Ghost Stories, one of those examples, and there's another one. Now, I'm not sure how often you've come across these, but I suspect that sort of ghosts associated with bridges aren't that uncommon, I should imagine. Because there's a tale of a motorcyclist in Wales who used to go through this village virtually every morning on his motorbike. And that one day he was taking this journey as usual early in the morning. It was light, but it was very foggy. And as he went across the bridge, he saw this woman standing there. And she was attired rather strangely, all in black, sort of in Victorian style dress. And she just sort of shot him this piercing look. She stood in the middle of the bridge at the side. And he was, I don't know, he was so sort of intrigued by this. He sort of he sped off across the bridge, then immediately turned and went back. And just couldn't find any trace of her, no trace of her whatsoever. So I wonder if there's a sort of folkloric association, you know, between sort of ghosts, bridges, suicides or accidents, premature deaths, that sort of thing.
I mean, there must be something. There must be something to that, because I guess bridges have an element of danger to them, and people
Yes.
would have clearly chosen them as very good places to end their lives. Have you heard of the Doggy Suicide Bridge near Glasgow?
The doggy suicide bridge, you
That's when
say?
they, well, not the dog
No,
suicide bridge. Sorry, in Glasgow,
no.
Ovington,
Oh, right.
what's it
No,
called?
that's a new
There's
one.
I'll find that for you and send it to you. We went. We
Okay,
did a
thank you.
piece on it. And literally, you look over this beautiful, beautiful ornate bridge that's about, a good 150 feet up above this
Right.
chasm. But the trees are so huge, they've almost grown right up to the edges of the bridge and the surrounding area. And dogs regularly throw themselves off this bridge.
Really?
It's
That's
terrible. I mean, I laugh, but it's terrible. Because why are they throwing themselves off the bridge? And I looked over and I thought, the trees are very close. Do they think that's not really so high up? Do they think, are they seeing squirrels in trees or something? I don't know. But apparently, it's been loads of them, not just 10 or 20 of them. It's just tons and tons of dogs go there and say, that's it, I've had enough of this life.
That is truly bizarre. Yeah. No, I've
Just,
never heard of anything like that
it's
before.
strange. It's strange. Yeah, it's a very strange thing. But the dogs, yeah, for some reason, it depresses them. They don't like it. They decide to end it all right there.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess we should end it there, but it has been wonderful. It has been great. I've enjoyed, really enjoyed, picking your brain and sort of getting your ideas as a folklorist, as a fictional writer as well, on these subjects about what goes into it. Why are we interested in these subjects? And also, for anybody listening out there, why we should definitely get your take on it and start reading your material, which we will put a link to in the interview for anyone
Okay.
listening.
Thank
It's been
you.
great. Thank you so much. For anybody out there who wants to get involved, who wants to send you a story or get in touch to discuss where they can support you and buy your products, where should they go?
I'm afraid it's all on Amazon.
That's okay.
No, I self-publish through Amazon, so that's my only outlet, I'm afraid, yeah.
They're international, so lucky
They
us.
are,
We can get it wherever
yes.
we might be listening. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been awesome. It's been amazing, and
Thank you, Andy.
I've
It's
learned
been great
something.
speaking. Thank you very much. It's been great. Okay, I'll catch up with your podcast soon. Thank
Bye-bye.
you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.